if the manager says something that the team doesn't agree on and you have a very hierarchical place, they're just going to follow up and they're not going to say anything. And if that boss is wrong, more mistakes are going to be made.
Hello and welcome back to Tech and Startups, the premier growth network for technology leaders. Let's get started.
And I had a chapter just to talking about selective process, because it's very important stage. If you can enter a company, then how can you be diverse? And there are several things we can do to make selective process a little more efficient towards diversity. And the first one is to believe in potential, even without proof. And sometimes when I say that, people are like, well, you want to hand people over opportunities that they don't deserve. But we already do that. There are several studies who show that if you're a man and you show your curriculum, people will hire you from what you can deliver in the future and you haven't delivered yet. But if you're a woman, you have to have already done that so that people can trust you to do that. For example, if you have to want to lead a team, but you have never led a team, people will not trust you to do that. So you see that there's a barrier that the women will never be able to cross it because they have to start somewhere. So we have to actually believe in potential without proof for minorities, because we already do that with people who are not. Also hire junior analysts in technology. That's very hard because people usually are looking for deadlines and projects that need to be done. So they think, well, if I hire a trainee or a junior, they were not going to be, I have to teach them and I'm going to be able to work with them. But if we're talking about minorities, that being people who have less opportunity, usually less money, those people sometimes are not, all of them are not going to be ready. They have to start somewhere in order to be ready to be a senior analyst, in order to be a manager. So you have to have junior positions in order to start bringing diversity in. It's very frustrating when I'm in several groups where they are focused on different diversities. And I always post their job opportunities that companies send me. They say, well, we want to hire more diverse people. Can you send this on a group that you are? And I do, but usually they want people to speak Portuguese, English, Spanish, to have a college degree, to maybe have studied abroad, and to have experience as a senior analyst. So that might be hard if you're talking about a population that has no opportunity from the beginning. Maybe they have access towards schools, towards colleges, and they live live further from the company. So you have to have junior positions. Also, when we advertise jobs, we have to look for the imagery and the terms that we use. That's not so much the case in English, but in Portuguese, when we say, for example, a developer, you have to have gender on the word. So you have to desenvolvedor, which is developer for a man, or desenvolvedora, which is developer for a woman. And usually people advertise developer, desenvolvedor, which is developer for a man. So how can women feel like they can try that position if you're using a male pronoun? Also, imagery. Usually, companies don't put a lot of effort or money into advertising jobs. So they go to maybe a free stock imagery and they take whatever is there. But if you take any tech role, and you Google it, you're going to see that it's always white people, usually men. We joke around that if you put like UX designer, there's this one model that he's always there. He's the one UX designer where he's going to see an all job advertisement because he's the look of what it means to be a UX designer. And if everybody's using that and I'm a woman and I'm black and I'm a junior, and I'm not sure if I can maybe apply for that position or not, not going to feel represented, and maybe it's going to bring my self-esteem a little down, and I'm not going to even apply. Other thing that can be done is to standardize questions. For me, that's pretty obvious because I'm a UX researcher. So, well, if I'm talking to 5 people, I want to get a summary of that. I have to standardize questions. But for human resources, that's not so obvious. They let the conversation roll. So maybe someone comes to an applicant comes to talk to me and we have a conversation, and another applicant comes and we have a different conversation. So it's pretty hard to actually make a comparison, because maybe one of them is closer to you because you came from similar backgrounds and the conversation flows more easily. And you have more information about that person now. So it gets easier to hire that person instead of the one who you couldn't talk about the neighborhood, that you couldn't talk about food because you are so different. You have to talk just about the questions that were written down. So if you standardize the questions, it's way more, you look for more technicalities, and it's actually fair with whoever is participating. Also, when we advertise jobs, we actually have to open the environments what we are advertising at. So I've seen, for instance, we have jobs that are for trainees. So you have to be studying to enter that job. And people advertise that on colleges that are really expensive and really hard to get in. So if you only advertise there, you already cut a big chunk of the population who don't have access to that college. And when we're talking about technology, is college that important? Because a lot of people just didn't go to college at all or quit college in the middle or at the end. And they're great at their jobs. But if we have that criteria, we are just actually cutting out people who don't have access instead of people who are good or not for the job. And the interviews themselves can be quite difficult for people. So I've seen and I've participated in interviews that were like a workshop and they took 4 or 5 hours. So in order for you to participate in an interview that takes 4 to 5 hours, you have to have time on your hands, you have to not be working, and you have to be able to pay to be there, to go and come back and maybe have a snack in the middle. So you're already cutting a lot of people who might not have access to all of that. So I always recommend remote interviews that makes possible for people who are from different areas, different regions, maybe state or country to participate. And the person who's participating, it's not paying to participate. In cities like here in São Paulo, you have it's so big that the areas that are on the further from the center, you can maybe take 2 hours to get to downtown where the companies are. So if you're talking about moving, taking a cab or an Uber or maybe public transportation for 2 hours, it's very expensive to come and go. And people who are looking for jobs, if they're going to one interview, they go to several interviews. So you're already cutting off a lot of people who don't have money for that transportation because it's not remote. And you have to think in alternative hours, because mostly people who have shorter incomes, they cannot just not work in order to look for work. They have to provide for themselves, maybe for their families. So they have to work in order to make a living. And they might be wondering if they maybe trying to get a better job or shift to start working in technology. And it's not going to happen if your interview takes time from 9 to 5. You have to actually think in alternative times, maybe at night, maybe on the weekend, maybe in the beginning of the morning. And it's not that hard. I've seen several companies doing it when they're interested in people who are really hard to get, maybe managers who are with a lot of a history working for a lot of companies. They can do remote interviews in alternate times. So why can we not do for this for everyone else? Another thing is the test. So people, and mostly in technology, they tend to ask for tests. And I don't think they're necessary. I've hear a lot of people, and this is maybe people don't always agree with that, but I've worked for Todges, the nonprofit I work for 3 years, and we actually open opportunities every 6 months. So, and I always look for people in technology every 6 months for the last 3 years, and we never ever asked for tests, and we never got people who weren't ready. So I'm also a teacher, so for me, I think it's really easy to come up with questions where you can realize if someone knows or not what you're talking about without actually applying a test. So it is possible, and I've been doing this for the last 3 years, and we never had one person who got in and we realized, oh, maybe this person doesn't know how to do what they say they did. And we also have something here in Brazil, what we call a test. So when you hire someone, the first 3 months, they are like a trial. And you can, it's not a full contract yet. And I think it's perfect if you are so interested in wondering if the person really knows how to do what they're doing. You have those 3 months to test it out without actually asking for a long, very hard test to do. Because you cut people off like this. If you have a test that requires maybe the use of Sketch, well, this person needs to have a MacBook. It's really expensive. If the test takes hours to do, this person needs to not work in order to have the time in their hands to do that. As a UX researcher, I've seen tests that actually require you to do research. Research is very expensive to do. You have to pay people to participate. You have to have a location. You have to have a prototype. You have to have maybe a camera to film, a cell phone to test it, another cell phone if you have different prototypes. So it's not a cheap thing to do. And if you ask that in an interview, you're going to just get people who don't have the money for it. They're just not going to participate. Another thing is to never assume gender. And that's specific for LGBT people, but it works for other people as well. You should always ask. I wonder, I think we can all imagine to go to a job interview. It is a tense situation. You're already worried. And you spend the whole time being called a different gender. So you're not going to perform the same way as other people. And I've never seen someone being offended of being asked, well, which pronoun do you prefer? Because if you ask, you're not going to make a mistake. You're going to use whichever pronoun that person tells you. If you don't have an accessible location, that's another thing. And when I say accessible, I mean for people with disabilities, but also for people who maybe just have different limitations. Let me give you an example. If a person is in a wheelchair and you can only get to your company where the interview is going to take place on an escalator, well, this person will not participate in their interview. If you have maybe very fancy chairs, but they are very small, so fat people, if they sit there, they're going to be uncomfortable the whole time, or they're going to harm themselves. They're going to be bruised, or they will not be able to use that chair at all. So that person is not going to be able to participate in the interview as well. And for sure, if they do participate, it's not going to be the same as people who didn't have that difficulty. Other thing that is very important is to eliminate exclusion criteria. And that's very common to have criteria that just exclude a lot of people. And they tend to be very harmful to diversity. For instance, you can exclude an age. And I've talked to people who work on human resources. And they say that their bosses actually ask that. So, well, maybe we're a technology company. We don't want to hire people who are too old because our team is very young. So this way, you're cutting off a lot of people, great people with experience from working with you. Some people say, well, since we have a lot of applicants, we're going to look for people who live close by because it's going to be easier for them. We will be able to depend more on them because they can come here whenever. But usually companies, mainly technology companies, they tend to be on areas that are the rent is really high. So if you take distance as an exclusion criteria, people with less money are going to be cut out from that. With that elimination. Also, as I said, college education. College is really expensive in any country. Even here in Brazil, where we have public colleges, they are free. So technically, anyone can take part in them. But in order to get in, you have a test. So in order to pass that test, you have to have gone to a really good school. And then good schools are expensive. So when you put college education as an exclusion criteria, you are cutting off diversity. Another thing is the second language. That's very common here in Brazil. I'm not sure if that's common on other countries, but it tends to ask for English on companies that all the clients are here from Brazil, all the employees are from Brazil, so why do you need English? But they ask that. And that's also another way to cut diversity because it is a course that you have to take on extra hours, maybe the English that they teach in schools are not, it's not that good. So you have to have money and time for that. Also, when you think about diversity, people usually think on marketing areas, design areas, and maybe customer service. And the reason being, because we have this image that design and diversity, we have different people, maybe with crazy colored hair and a lot of tattoos. So if you have people with crazy colored hair and tattoos, LGBT people will be okay in the middle. And maybe a black person, it's okay. Maybe a person with disability, because everybody's different here. It's a rainbow. And when we look at customer service, they are usually the jobs that pay less and they are more entry-level jobs. And so you put people, diversity there, and but you don't look to the rest of the company, because it's just easier to do it this way when you're talking about maybe accountant or law, those are area, or engineering. Those are actually fields which are less diverse, and it's harder when you get there to defend that you have to do so. So I always say that, great, if you only, between nothing and marketing and customer service, well, if you just have customer service and marketing, that's better. But it shouldn't stop there. You should try to put diverse people in other areas as well. And since I've said a lot of things that needs to be done, I also brought two resources that can help. The first one is Nappy. It's an image stock website. It's free, and it's focused on Black people, because I've been there. I work with people who work with advertisement, and sometimes they don't have the budget. They have to use free stock image. And whatever you type there is going to be white people, no matter what the field, what the product is, it's what is there. So Nappy is there so that you can have, maybe you're going to advertise a job opportunity, you can go there and you have different pictures. And the other one is tenquete.org. That's a Brazilian website that it's the similar situation, but it's for LGBT imagery. So maybe you're doing something that portrays couples, or maybe you want to show people who are non-binary. There you have images that are free and that they are more diverse. So you don't have to always depend on maybe Shutterstock or iStock, on those big websites. They have those images that are really not diverse. And I wanted to end with a quote from Maya Angelou, which I really like. She says that we all should know that diversity makes for a rich tapestry, and we must understand that all the threads of the tapestry are equal in value, no matter what their color. I also want to leave with my contact information here. So that's my email and my LinkedIn. If you want to reach out, I add everybody. And if you want to have further questions, maybe you can ask now, you can ask later, emailing me or reaching out on LinkedIn. That's it. Thank you very much. And I think now we have time for questions.
Yeah, Rafaela, thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us. We're just going to do a couple questions before we move into a panel, a follow-up panel. And Brian asked a great one from the chat, but I'm going to ask that we're going to do that one in the panel. And I'm going to unmute Erica, who has a question about organizational change. Erica, do you want to read that question or share that question with Rafaela?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the talk, Rafaela. This has been very good. You hit on a lot of great points. A lot of things that I've experienced as well, working at different companies, especially the nonprofit issue as well, where you actually see that more people, then there's more diversity within nonprofits, which tends to happen a lot, that people, you know, will concede things like, you know, getting paid a little bit less or having a little bit more rougher hours and expectations, because they want to hold on to working at a place that has a lot of diversity, and they see different people, whether they themselves are underrepresented or if they're somebody who, you know, they like to be able to see diversity wherever they go. So one of the question that I had was regarding to that, How do you balance educating professionals about increasing diversity when the organization is defensive? Because some organizations do know that there is a problem when they look around, they do the neck test, like you were saying, and they see that, well, we only, you know, in a lot of our organization and our leadership, we only have two different, you know, types of people stamped across the board, and the people who, you know, are managers and things like that, same way. But there also, a lot of times, and I've seen this at places I've worked at where usually the places that do have that issue, a lot of times there is a hesitation and a reluctance from leadership, even though they know that there's a problem, and they know they need to fix it, and they do see an employment bleed, if you will, where people are leaving because, you know, they're seeing all of the, you know, people who are, you know, different than the rest of the group, you know, having dissatisfaction, they're leaving, but they, you know, but the organization is scared about looking like the bad guy or seeming like they are doing something wrong, even though they do want to solve it. How would you be able to help facilitate that conversation to, you know, kind of, if you will, empower them to see, you know, the problems that they had before, but in a way that is impactful for getting them to a solution?
I've seen this in several companies. Since at Toges, we have several projects, and one of them is consulting. So we go to companies which have that issue. They are thinking on ways of solving it. Maybe they are already trying to, but they're not being able to, or they're the ones to get maybe make greater efforts. And what I've seen is two things, actually. Sometimes it comes from a place of ignorance, and that's a little easier to solve because you just have to bring information if you can, if you have access to all those people. Usually companies, they have a newsletter, they have events, usually focused on the areas where you work. So for instance, I work at a bank. We always have events talking about fintechs or financial new services and laws. So if we have those events and newsletters going on, we can put great information there to solve the ignorance problem. But I've also seen companies, sometimes people, they don't want to be blamed. And they would want to say, well, in that case, you were racist because you could promote two people and you promote this one and not that one. And this specific situation, it was based on ethnicity. And people don't want that. And they would be very defensive of that because when you have a specific situation, they'll try to bring out other reasons. And it's always a hard conversation to have. So what we've been doing in companies on those events is always bring a third party. And that's where the nonprofit I work really tends to go. Because when you're talking about people in a hierarchical different situation, so maybe one is a boss, the other one's a manager, it's always hard to open up. So if the manager says something that the team doesn't agree on and you have a very hierarchical place, they're just going to follow up and they're not going to say anything. And if that boss is wrong, more mistakes are going to be made. So if you bring a third party, maybe a consultancy agency, a nonprofit, we tend to make events with promoting a safe space. And that's important because there are companies who care about it, but they don't know what to do. And maybe some companies, they don't care at all. If they don't care at all, there's not much that can be done. I would just say maybe leave. But the ones that are actually caring about it and they want to do something, but they have this conflict where they don't know what to do, they just have the desire, it's very important to create safe spaces where people can open up. Because sometimes if you're... as myself, reading about it and you're going to a lot of events, the conversation is really evolved. So you're talking about subjects that those people maybe don't know that exists. So you have to go a few steps back and start from the beginning. And maybe you have to have those conversations when you say, well, maybe this exists. So it's very in the beginning of the conversation about diversity, but it has to start somewhere. So I've seen events where we create, for instance, one activity where people would write down on post-it notes what their prejudices were, the ones that they knew they had, and it was anonymous. So they would write it down, they would put it on a pile, and we put it on a wall. And I've heard things about this type of activity where we saw, they read things that were just so blatantly prejudiced that you see that maybe you have to start working on the beginning. You have to show, well, everybody here is a human and everybody is worth the same. So it's very on the base. And if people have this kind of belief, they're not going to share it because they know it's wrong. But since they are not able to share it, they can change it. So what I've heard from people who do this, I'm not exactly on this consulting and ethologies. I'm on a technological area, which we have an app. But people who work in consultancy, they've told us examples, for once in a company, where one of the post-it notes, they say, well, I am prejudiced about Black people's smell. That's so ancient when we talk about racism. We're not having this conversation. We are too evolved to have this kind of conversation. But if there's one person with an important role in a company that believes this kind of things, we need to change that in the beginning. And that's the hard part. So we maybe have to bring historical information to see why do we have this belief, how it was constructed, so we can deconstruct that. There's this famous story here in Brazil where people used to believe that you couldn't drink milk and eat mango at the same time. And a lot of elderly people believe that. And if you go to look for the origin of that, it's actually because when you have plantations and slaves, they would be really underfed and they would go to the cows and take the milk from them. And they will go to the fields where you have mangoes, because mango here is something that just grows everywhere, and they would eat it. So the people who owned them, they invented that, and everybody who they found out that did that, maybe took the milk and took the mango, they would either kill that person or heavily beat. So that's the origin of that. Till today, you can find people who believe, no, if you take milk and mango together, you're going to be sick. So sometimes if you bring the origin, the history in it, it's enough to break a belief. So when they saw this case for this person who wrote that on a post-it note, they actually brought the history, how this was constructed and with what goals. And after you break that down, it's easier to actually open up and talk about the subject. But I think you have to maybe have third party doing that, because if you are working with people like that, I would hate to be in a company that took part in an event and know that someone who works with me put a note like that. So you have to have maybe a neutral part and make this safe space. Where I work, we have affinity groups. I don't know if that's well translated, but usually the one that I'm at is like a women group. You have LGBT groups, groups that are just for people with disabilities, just for Black people, just for Asian people, so that they can meet in their environment, because sometimes companies are so big that, and they have so small representation that maybe they're in different areas and don't know each other. And together you can be stronger to make it, maybe try to change things. So I see that working as well. But I think that when you have a lot of prejudice somewhere, the safe space is the thing that matters the most, because we are in a world that is going towards more diversity everywhere, and people are really struggling to follow that. Some people from ignorance, for just maybe lack of interest, but they are struggling. So you need that safe space and empathy also with the person who is harming others, so that this person could change. If you just come out pointing out and showing that the person did wrong, maybe the person committed some prejudice against someone, that person's going to get defensive. And although maybe it would feel really good doing that, if you want to be constructive, I think usually what works best is looking for safe spaces of some sort.
Rafael, thanks so much for that answer. And thanks, Erica, for the question. And I want to thank you again, Rafaela, for presenting this to us and bringing us so much insight. I've got a lot of notes here, and I was really surprised by the similarities between some of what's happening in your city and what some of what's happening in the other cities around the world. Really meshes with some of the experiences I've had or heard about in the Bay Area and California and Silicon Valley. So it's wherever you go, it's a similar world, huh?
Globalization.
Absolutely.
We've gotten some fantastic insights on strengthening your team. But what about other ways you can strengthen your team? I've assembled an 8-page guide on the 4 quadrants of strengthening your team with key insights from more than 11 veteran tech team leaders. To get yours, grab the link below this video. I'm so glad you joined us today. If this video was helpful, give it a like. Go ahead and subscribe and hit the bell so that tech and startup videos continue to show up in your feed. I'll see you in the other videos.